this is the Angry GM, and this is the supplemental Q&A portion of the proofread aloud of My World Has a Sky and Yours Should Too. So I'm just waiting for some questions and comments to be typed into the question and comment thread. But I'd like to remind you that if you are fortunate enough to be connected to Discord when I suddenly announce that in 2 hours I will be doing a live proofread aloud, you too can participate in this crap. So hang out on the Discord, and probably it'll get a little bit more regular once we get into December and I'm back on the schedule of, you know, finishing an article on Fridays instead of finishing an article the morning of the day it's supposed to go live. So, yeah, that's that. Meanwhile, we do have a question. Queasel, the benefactor. Well, she is technically the benefactor of this article, but also the requester of this article is asking, thanks for the article, Angry. You're welcome. Really enjoyed this one. You should have. It was awesome. I'm here to shamelessly ask if we can get a sneak peek at those diegetic time tracking rules. Oh, no, you cannot. I said another time, another place. And I stand by that. Okay, no. It's really simple. Actually, here's the issue that I was trying to deal with. Okay, since nobody else is asking a question or a comment. So the minute somebody posts a question or a comment, by the way, you're going to break this. Okay, so here's we already know that, like, the tension pool is, like, the god of timekeeping. You know, it's the single best mechanic anyone has ever invented for role-playing game time mechanics, and whoever invented it should be awarded with a whole lot of money and some chocolate. But the thing is that for tracking activity in a day, one of the problems you run into is that while there are a wonderful 24 hours in a day, which is perfectly divisible by 6, it's sort of weird to break the day down into 6 4-hour chunks and then try to match them up with specific times on the clock and then go even further and say, okay, and in this chunk of time, this day part, whatever it is, you know, daylight or twilight or darkness, because I have divided the day into three stages of lighting: daylight, darkness, and twilight. Okay, here is the only problem I ran into. It's that actually aligning that stuff with hours on the clock, right? And saying, okay, so from midnight to 4 a.m. is, you know, the first day part, and 4 a.m. to 8 a.m. is the second day part, yada, 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 yada. Okay. What I really needed to do was remember that we're playing a medieval fantasy game and nobody tracks time that precisely, right? It's not like, oh, it's 3:57 now and, you know, we have a meeting at 12. You know, people were kind of broad about the times to begin with, and they would say, you know, in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening. So all I needed to do was give each day part a name, like dawn, morning, afternoon, evening, dusk, and night. And then invent an excuse for the Angryverse to use those terms in world. And so, as a, you know, religious and historical tradition, the human cultures of the world divide the world into 6 bells. There are 6 bells. This refers, like, church bells calling certain times, because it's always the church bells that keep track of the time, right? So there is the dawn bell and the morning bell and the afternoon bell and the evening bell and the dusk bell and the night bell or the midnight bell, whatever. So now I have a way where my players can actually refer to the times in the world that is vague enough that I don't have to say, well, dawn is between 4 a.m. and, or midnight and 4 a.m. or whatever. So that when, because, you know, when I'm trying to say, okay, in wintertime, there's only 8 hours of daylight, right? Then it becomes hard for me to decide if I've already made up this clock of which hours on the clock get slotted with the daylight, because it just doesn't line up right. But if I'm suddenly vague about the whole thing and say, well, you know, the afternoon, the morning and the afternoon bells are in daylight, and then by the evening bell, it's already twilight, and then, you know, it's twilight, whatever. I can say all of that, and then, you know, now I have a simple little diagram, and I have a pretty diagram that I made for my game and my world for tracking time during the day based on the 6 bells of the day. that also aligns with using the tension pool mechanic, that allows for the assumption that generally any activity done around town is probably going to take a few hours. And there you go. That's basically a preview of my diegetic timekeeping system that I will be talking more about in January. Quizzle is asking, do you have anything you particularly like to associate with full moons and eclipses in the Angryverse? I was going to blot off because I immediately eclipses dominated that. It's like, eclipses are these rare things, right? So it's like, you know, every GM's always like, oh, when there's the double eclipse or whatever, this magic happens or whatever. But in terms of full moons, like I guess I could talk about the lunar phases and the craziness that happens there. And it's more sort of just traditions and superstitions around it. But essentially, you know, I have Azura the silvery blue moon, or the Azura the silver moon, as she is called. And she is associated with basically the order of the heavens, right? She is the keeper of time and the lighter of night and all of that. And she goes on a very strict 28-day cycle. So every month starts with a new moon, and on the 14th day is a full moon, and then it ends with another new moon, which also identifies the you know, important holidays, whatever. The red moon, Chrisma, the red moon, goes through her phases somewhat randomly. That is not to say that she like suddenly decided today is crescent and tomorrow is full or anything like that, but she speeds through her phases at different rates of time. So she could rise as a crescent moon tonight, and then within 2 days, she's already at a gibbous, and then she's full 1 day later. And then she sits around being full for 3 weeks before suddenly she goes into a waning gibbous and then all the way back down to, you know, to nothing. And the way I manage that is by just looking at whatever phase she was last time I ran the game and then saying, yeah, that's still good. She's still a crescent or whatever, unless all of the sudden I decide she needs to be full or new or whatever. She is associated with evilness. People don't trust the red moon. She is very chaotic. She is, and scary, and the color of all the visceral things that cause fear in humanity. So on the nights when she is full and there is a new silver moon, there's no silver moon and there is a full red moon, those are considered to be particularly unlucky nights. Once every 10 years, I think, I established that the new moons come in sync. And it's always on the 14th of Springtide. Every 10 years on the 14th of Springtide, both moons go new. And there is a festival around that and a mysterious comet that appears that has astrological significance, yada, yada, yada. And the only reason that happened is because I decided to write a story around that particular festival. So, yeah, so be it. I mean, that's... And that's why every little detail happens, okay? The full red moon and the silver moon being new. I added that in an adventure, and then I reprised it at the AngryCon adventure that I ran just because it's cool. But okay, Proselis is saying, thank you for the article. A strong reminder to do something I keep meaning to do better. Yeah, but all you got to do is just narrate it. So it's not even anything you have to do. Doug, level 12 Code Monkey, I had to check out partway through. What are your months named? So each month is named after the season of which it is a part. So we have Spring's Wax, the rising of spring, Spring's Tide, the height of spring, and spring's ebb, the fall of spring. Then you have summer's wax, summer's tide, and summer's ebb. Autumn's wax, autumn's tide, and autumn's ebb, because I like autumn better than fall. And then winter's wax, winter's tide, and winter's ebb. Yada, yada, yada. So simple as that. Tangential, but does proficiency in survival wilderness lore imply the character in question can navigate by the stars? Sort of. Navigation by the stars is actually kind of tricky, but then, like, people assume these godlike abilities to navigate anyway, right? Like, Like, you think when people say navigate in the D&D world and like, can you navigate by the stars? It's basically, can you find north or another direction? You know, and that's all it comes down to. Okay. This is not like GPS level navigating where it's like, well, I know my exact coordinates and yada, yada, yada. That's like, okay, that way's north-ish. Okay. And then can you navigate by the, I can friggin' navigate by the stars. I actually know how to find the North Star. It's pretty faint, but I can find the North Star, you know? The biggest trouble, by the way, with navigation is figuring out east-west navigation, but again, that's positional navigation, not dead reckoning. So, like, what you have to understand is that navigation is by dead reckoning. It's basically knowing the direction you're trying to go and then trying to set that direction. Okay, that's the best you can do. You know, short of a compass and a very detailed map, it's all going to come down to either dead reckoning or navigating by landmarks. You know, so the idea that you could walk out of a town and find a specific dungeon just by walking to it because you have it drawn on a map is, you know, it's kind of fairly ludicrous. So, I mean, there's, you know, certain acceptable losses or certain acceptable breaks from reality, right? That said, does proficiency in survival wilderness law imply that the character in question can navigate by the stars? Yes, insofar as it implies that the character can navigate by anything. Navigating by the stars is actually easier than navigating during the day. Okay, during the day is trickier. You know, and it's not just the stars, it's all sorts of tricks. Okay, like, yeah. Honestly, the best thing you can do is get a book on wilderness survival and read it and learn how navigation actually works, and then you can infuse your game with that idea. Do you have any particular types of challenges you like to draw from or augment with weather? No, whatever just suits my fancy. There's nothing particular. You know, and like I said, I don't do it that much because here's the problem with challenges based on the weather. It's that the players can do very little about it other than survive unless the players themselves are survival experts. Okay, so like I could set a challenge. Oh, you're in the wilderness and, you know, the snow is heavy. What do you do? Well, not for nothing. People in the modern era really don't know how to handle that shit. Like they just don't. It's not part of our needs anymore. So it's like, I don't know. Can I look for a cave? Light a fire? Like, people don't know how to survive. So then you have this thing where what you have to do is say, well, your character knows how to survive, right? So just roll a survival check. And then you end up in a situation where, you know, now it's just, okay, here's the problem, roll to survive it. Right. And that's the problem with most challenges based on the wilderness is they're not actually very interesting to play unless you have very knowledgeable players. And if you are knowledgeable yourself, but your players are not, then you can sit there and you can say, well, you would know to do this or this or this. And if you're really, really smart, you can say you would know to do this or this or this. If you do this, here's the risk, here's the reward, and you'd be giving up this. And if you do this, here's the risk, here's the reward. And basically break everything down into these binary choices of, do you want to accept this risk for this reward or accept this risk for this reward or push your luck for this reward? And like at that point, it's not open-ended problem solving anymore. Okay, so challenges based on the weather and survival by themselves, just not super interesting. That said, you know, if you have a monster, like let's say there is a monster that has a damaging aura, so that if you stand right up next to the monster, it's going to damage you in melee. And the party knows about this going in, and so they all, like, you know, it's like, well, we'll, you know, we all got bows and crossbows and whatever, and we figured out how to snare the monster, and now we're going to fire get the monster in a snare, and then we're just going to shoot it to death, right? And then, well, fuck, it's raining. Oh, gosh, it's raining, and now our arrows don't work because arrows work very, very poorly in the rain. Okay. One of the big problems with arrows in the rain was the glues that they would use to keep the fletchings in place were water-based adhesives. They were the best adhesives we could come up with at the time. And as soon as they got wet, the fletchings would come loose and the arrows would lose all stability and just go, not like go everywhere, but you know, like it was a lot harder to aim arrows. So now all of a sudden, now you have like this devil's choice. Do you stay back and fire pelting arrows at this thing as it's trying to break free of the snare with half your arrows missing because of the rain? Or does somebody run up and take the risk of the damaging aura to just try to cut it down quicker? Do you find another way to keep it trapped in the snare longer so that you can kill it? Do you retreat and do something else? You know, it's that when the weather adds a spice to a challenge, you know, that's usually better. Man, I just sort of petered out and lost my energy at the end there. But you know what I'm saying. You know, it's think about the ways the weather will screw up the party's tactics. That's really like, how will it make the first order optimal strategies more difficult? That's about the best thing you can do with the weather. I'm not saying it's the only thing, but it's the best thing. You know what? I actually do want to add one more thing to that whole. Do you have any particular challenge that you like to build around the weather that Quetzal asked? Because this actually plays into what I just posted Wednesday, Friday, the last article that I posted into Early Access, the one about maybe we don't need failure states anymore. Okay. And that is this whole idea of thinking in terms of building challenges, okay, and creating obstacles, because there is more to that idea than just maybe we don't need to think in terms of survival and failure. And this is one of the best arguments for letting the weather be random, okay, is I don't want to sit there and think, okay, I have designed this monster challenge, but I need to make it more challenging, so I'm also going to add the weather. Instead, I just want to put a monster in my game. Okay, and I want to know what the monster is, and I want to give the players the opportunity to learn about the monster so that they can come up with strategies and tactics and whatever strategies and tactics come up with are okay. And then, once all that is said and done, if I roll and suddenly there is a blizzard halfway through monster hunt day, then the players just have to deal with that shit. That's life. And that's what role-playing games excel in. Okay? There is a game design element to it, that as a GM, you should be designing a game that is a satisfying gameplay experience. But there is also a point where you as a GM have to recognize that the best stories, the best RP part of the RPG, comes from this idea that the story is made of all this crap just happening, and it's the story of people dealing with the shit that falls in front of them. Right? I probably did not say that very well. But the idea that some of the best stories that are going to come out of the game are the ones where, you know, just it's just the players dealing with what happens. You know? Let's see. Proselys is asking, have you done stuff with magical weather, like poisonous fog or literal acid rain? I mean, sure. Sure, I mean, you know, can I think of anything right off the bat? No, but I bet I could. I mean, like, that's a classic thing, right? Like, you know, you got your thunder planes in Final Fantasy, and you got, you know, the swamp of acid rain, or the poisonous swamps and poisonous fog. Those are always a thing, right? But once again, the question becomes, like, if you just drop this on the player, like, oh, surprise, an acid rainstorm has washed through the area, and now your skin is dissolving. What do you? It's like, well, okay. I don't know. Can we run under a tree, run under a cave, build a tent? It's like, well, there's no caves or trees. Then I guess we all just watch our skin slough off and die. You know, it's like, once again, there's this tricky little issue of, well, how do you keep it from just, well, okay, make a saving throw every hour or every 4 hours or whatever it is. Just hope the damage doesn't kill you. Which, again, I mean, that can be okay, Right? That whole, like, you have to do whatever you're doing quick because the poisonous fog is chewing away at you. And I have done things, like, the party was exploring a volcano-based dungeon not too long ago. I think I mean over a year ago, so whatever. But anyway, and there were areas where there was poisonous gas. And when they went through these areas, they made a saving throw. And if the saving throw failed, they had a negative condition on them. And this is 3.5. So I had a lot of conditions to work with. I think it was like the nauseated condition or the sickened condition or the debilitated some condition, right? And it imposed a penalty and they had to decide whether they were going to just deal with this penalty or, you know, run out, get some fresh air, try again, put water over or put wet cloths over their red. And if they come up with a good idea, then I give them a bonus, right? It's like, well, I'm going to damp this cloth and put it over my face. Well, okay, fine. That could work, you know. But beyond that, it's just kind of a thing, right? So again, it's like, what do you do with it unless the players... It's either a plot point or it's a backdrop. Right. So either the adventure is about removing the poisonous fog from the poisonous swamp so that we can go explore the poisonous swamp or finding the magical, you know, mask of poisonous swamp protection, or it's and this adventure is more difficult because you're constantly making saving throws. And every time you fail a saving throw, you gain a level of exhaustion or some shit like that. Right. Those are your two options for it. You know, because there's nothing else the players can do, you know, unless you try to rely on them bringing in player knowledge. Okay. The real question you always have to worry about is, if my players don't come up with something clever, am I just screwing them? Okay. It can never be that. So if it's like, oh my God, there's acid rain and it will kill you, and then you're waiting for them to come up with the clever idea of, oh, we just need to build anti-acid tents with our, you know, because we just bought that canvas of acid resistance, you know, three adventures ago. And you're sitting there like, why don't they think of the canvas of acid resistance they literally acquired three adventures ago? And none of them are. None of them are thinking of it. And now you're just sitting there and you're meanwhile, oh, you take 10 more damage, you take 10 more damage, you take 10 more damage. Oh, you're dead, you're dead, you're dead, you're dead. And there, great. You just killed your party. Okay, because the only difference between success and failure was their ability to come up with the clever plan. Okay, you never want success or failure to hinge on your players being clever. You want to give them a reason to be clever. It's like, look, if you don't come up with something clever, you're going to have this penalty, and then the dragon is going to come out, you know, and then you're going to have to fight the dragon while you're debilitated from sulfur gas. That's going to suck. It's survivable, but it's going to suck, you know, and that's where the difference lies. It's like which is why, again, survival challenges, I'm just talking circles now, and I realized that I did get like a something minute warning, didn't I? I got a some minute warning, 5 minute warning. Okay, so I'm talking in circles now, and I'm saying the same things over and over again. And this again goes to the point that, like, it's so funny, because I just wrote a whole article saying, look, all this weather and shit, it's not about challenges, it's not about mechanics, and you shouldn't sweat any of that. The only reason to have weather in the sky is because it grounds people in the world. And everybody's like, well, how are we going to make challenges based on that? It's like, oh my gosh. It's like, what am I speaking Javanese or Esperanto or something? Okay. Anyway, I kid. But anyway, this has been the Q&A for the Proofread Aloud. These will both get posted live sometime, or posted live. These will both get posted sometime within a few days. And meanwhile, I have another article that is going up on Wednesday, and again, I'm going to say I probably will not have time to do a proofread aloud on it, or at least record, do a live proofread aloud with Q&A, especially with the holiday coming, but then Wednesday is going to come, and I'm going to make good time on it, and then it's going to make a liar of me, so we'll probably be here again Wednesday afternoon. That's not a promise, but if you were looking to hang out and listen to a live proofread aloud and do a Q&A, Wednesday might be a good day to guess. Just saying.